So before we begin then, let us all take a moment to pay homage to the Supremely Enlightened One, the Unvanquished and the Undefeated One, our Master, our Guide, our Teacher. As you do so, let us also remind ourselves that when we bring our palms together in veneration, this is not a mere veneration to the Buddha, but it is also a pledge that you take upon yourselves. This is an oath of allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem. It is a promise that you make unto yourselves. I shall explain how all that works as we go along this journey.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Okay. So we're beginning to see some familiar faces, some regular faces, and a few irregular faces. Some square ones, some triangular ones. Good. I want you to go on this journey. This is a journey. It's not usually one that happens. I mean, the transformation that the Dhamma can make, it's not usually one that happens just overnight. I mean, there have been the odd occasion. You'll have heard of stories of great elders of the past, the Maharathan Mahanses, who upon listening to just one talk, one sermon by the fully awakened one, you know, that was it. That was all they needed. But you must understand that two factors were quite different from what they are today. First and foremost, I am not the Supremely Enlightened One. Far from it. He had the ability to examine what defilements, what cankers remain in a mind. How prepared the mind is. He could examine you like a physicist might examine a substance under an electron microscope and look at its makeup. He could examine you and work out exactly what you needed to hear to understand the Dhamma. But of course, today we don't have. We are not availed of that opportunity. The compassion that he had in his mind towards all sentient beings is unparalleled, is unequaled. The compassion that I might have for you is perhaps a drop in the ocean compared to the vast ocean that he was. It is beyond compare and is never one that I can achieve or even aspire to. That doesn't stop one from trying though. So here we are. But on the other hand, I myself sometimes wonder, perhaps I just didn't have enough merit to be born in the time when the Buddha was there. If I had been born then, with enough merit, perhaps you and I would never have met and the story would have been a very different one. Perhaps that was just not meant to be. But nonetheless, we are all fortunate enough to have been born in an era where the Buddha Dhamma still prevails, even. The truth of his words still remain. I mean, the truth always was there. The Buddha was someone who discovered the truth rather than invented the truth. So he went on a journey, and a journey that we must go on as well. The only difference being, He didn't have a teacher to guide him. He didn't have a teacher to show him right from wrong. He didn't have anyone to give him instruction or guidance. We, of course, are very different from that. See, the price you have to pay for having no teacher in the pursuit of happiness is becoming a Buddha. I mean, given the chance, I wouldn't opt for that. I would never opt to become a Buddha, a Supreme Buddha. As great and glorious he might be, just the mere fact that you have to go looking for the truth yourself, and the fact that you have to engage in many a task, an activity, an exercise, a journey, which might lead you nowhere. You know, just think about this for a second. You know, in some schools of thought, some philosophies, maybe some religions even, I think that would probably be the right word. In some religions, you have to make some sacrifices. In some religions, not maybe all of them, but in some of them, you have to make sacrifices. And some of these sacrifices would amount to self-mortification. In some religions, in some faiths, perhaps one must walk on fire before the truth, before the light, before the awareness, the awakenedness is bestowed upon you. You know what some of these religions might be. I don't need to name them. In some religions, in some faiths, you have to go hungry for a period of time. You have to starve yourself. And this is not a criticism or anything of that sort. I'm just saying that it's the truth. In order to find emancipation, in order to find liberation, in order to find whatever they believe is freedom, these are some of the sacrifices that you have to make. In some religions, you have to actually sacrifice animals. You have to shed blood. But the self-mortification part alone, just think about it. Hold your breath for a prolonged period of time, submerged in water. Hold your breath for as long as you can, and then just the moment before you suffocate, rise up and take a deep breath of air, and do that several times over, maybe over a period of 10 years, 15, 20 years, until one day you shall realize freedom. This would be the teaching of some religions. In some religions, they'll say that you have to pluck out every single strand of hair on your body before you are given liberation. In some religions, you have to lie prostrate on the ground and roll, perhaps sometimes over hot coals, before you are allowed to enter paradise. What do you have to do in Buddhism? To achieve your liberation, how much of that sacrifice must you make? How many meals must you have to skip? How long has to go hungry? How long have you to starve yourself? What sacrifices do you have to make? Do you have to hold your breath? What do you think? The answer is yes. I can see you saying no, but the answer is yes. The only difference is, in what we are doing here, all those sacrifices have to be made, but it is not you and I who make those sacrifices. He does. We don't. He holds his breath for all of us. He starts himself for all of us. He plucks out every hair on his body. He goes through self-mortification for all of us. Because he's got to try everything. Because he's got no teacher. He's got no teacher not because he was stubborn. He's got no teacher because there was no one to show him the path. No one knew. You know how long he had to starve himself. The first statue that we built at our monastery was not one of the Buddha. It was one of the Bodhisattva. Every morning to wake up, to look at that and to remind ourselves. Someone made that sacrifice for all of us. So that we don't have to. He walked on red hot coals. Because the teachers that he had in the time said, that is what you have to do for liberation. And so he tried that. Going from town to town, from village to village, from city to city, all on foot, sometimes maybe carriage, but mostly on foot. Going to every teacher in the land, spending time with them and hearing what they had to say, learning it, practicing it, and practicing it fully, because he never left any stone unturned. He tried it all. He tried it all. Believe you me, he tried it all. Until finally he realized, none of this is going to work. You know, if the Bodhisattva had been around today, he would be trying everything that you're trying right now. He'll probably try going to med school. Because that would be some of the things that some of the teachers today would say, in the name of happiness, try med school. He might try law school after med school. And all the other things that today we seem to do in the name of happiness. All the other things. Ultimately, when he realized that none of this works. See, he wanted to find a way to free himself and all of us from the sorrows and the grief and the bereavement, the agonizing pain that we find ourselves in. We must not take this lightly. You know, it sometimes does it not sometimes feel that it was just per chance that you were born into perhaps a family who are of this faith? Now, I'm sure there will be some in the audience who are not of the Buddhist faith, and that's perfectly fine, but somehow your circumstances led you here. In some religions, you know, it is completely against, it is forbidden to even listen to a teaching that is of a different faith. But somehow, you know, we are born in an age where people are free to make their own choices. Freedom of choice is a biggie. It's so important to have freedom of choice. People don't realize that that is not the most important thing. It's the choice of freedom that is the most important thing. Do you understand the difference between the two? The freedom of choice and the choice of freedom? What do people fight for? Which one? The freedom of choice. Long time ago, when men had the right to vote, what did the women get together and say? We want to have the freedom of choice. What choice? The choice of choosing our leaders, So they fought for the freedom of choice. Back further, when it was just the white people who had the privileges and the opportunities, the black people got together and they fought for the freedom of choice. Who fought for the choice of freedom? See, we always seem to be making the same, the wrong fight. We are always in the wrong battle. We are always in the wrong war. But someone made that choice, the choice of freedom, and then that choice of freedom is now available to us. So we mustn't take it lightly. This is not an opportunity we get every day. So two things are different from back then. One, you don't have the Supreme Buddha today. And two, people then were far more interested in their own salvation. You know, that was called the Axial Age in the timeline of human development, and if you've done any study in anthropology, that was called the Axial Age, where a lot of philosophers, you know, walked the surface of the earth along the same time, Socrates and the Buddha himself and so on. Because they had time to think. Today we don't have time to think. Today we have time to act. We act now and think later. That is why life seems to be full of regrets. But back then, people had the time to think. You see, nowadays, because the world is so rapid and things are so fast, you can make a choice and act on it almost immediately, can't you? It's just a press of a button. It's just a phone call away. When you're angry with someone, if you lived a few years ago, maybe in your grandparents' age, if you were angry with someone, they had to actually go to their homes, even if it was to simply vent their frustration and anger. You had to, a few decades ago, you had to get on a bus. But even before then, if you go way before that, you had to walk, and sometimes on foot. The person that you were angry with lived, say, 50 kilometers away. Now, you had to walk. Half a kilometer down the road, you're like, nah, can't be bothered. Turn around, come back home. So the next time you meet will probably be in 3 months' time. Or in 4 months' time. Maybe in six full moons' time. That's how they measured time back then, by the number of full moons that would pass between two events. So then by that time, you'd given yourself enough time to consider the circumstances. Why might he or she have said something like that? Oh, now I understand. And it gave people time to just go and reflect on things. But today we don't have the time to do that, because we just don't have the time to think. We have the time to act, not think. Does it not seem, when you watch TV, that all the thinking has already been done on your behalf? When you're online, when you're watching TV, when you're reading the newspapers, right? Do you not feel that the thinking has already been done? All you got to do is act. Back then it was not so. You had to think, is this the right choice to be making? And then you'd have the time to go and consult. Consult people who are wiser than you. Today, young children even don't have the time to consult their parents. Parents in the room, wouldn't you agree? Because today technology is so advanced that, you know, you don't have to ask your parents, you can ask Google. When I wanted to my first girlfriend, I went and asked my mother if she thought that she was a good fit for me. Today, you ask Google. because you can't wait to get home, and even if you did, mother's not at home. Father's not at home. Too busy. Too busy acting. As in not acting, but too busy taking action. Far little time to think. Because today you're thinking, you've got to do on behalf of others. You know, whatever profession you're in, just think about it. How many of you take your work home with you? You don't have to answer. Just give me a virtual nod. A virtual nod. How many of you have to take your work home with you? I don't necessarily mean picking up the files, packing it in your bag and bringing it home and then, you know, taking it all out and putting it down on the dressing table and start working on it. I don't mean it literally in that way. But today you can carry your work with you just on your mobile device. And even if you didn't do that, it's all up here. When you go to bed at night, what do you think about? Kissing your children goodnight or the meeting that you have tomorrow with your next prospective buyer? Or your next client, or the work meeting that has to take place, and the decisions that you have to make on behalf of your company, your workplace, before they give you that next promotion, or that juicy bonus that you get at the end of the year. So we don't have time for our children now. We only have time to bring children into this world. What we don't have time is to bring them up. You've got me started now. You know how big a problem drugs is out there? It's just getting worse and worse by the day. I only know about it because I hear stories from you. From the people who visit us at the monastery. Because we don't do drugs at the monastery. But outside the four walls of the monastery, things happen apparently. And people come and tell horror stories. Drugs is just one problem taking over. It's a big problem nonetheless. It's destroying your children right from the inside. And once it becomes an addiction, there's no saving them. Rehabilitation centers of these days, you know, they do try, but unfortunately, something about their methods is not working. 60%, 70% of all drug addicts relapse. That's a huge number. 70% relapse. Half of all of the prisoners in the prisons are in there because of crimes related to drugs. If I spoke to the mother of one of those men in the prison today, young men in the prison today, before the boy was imprisoned, and I told her, "Mother, think about your child. You brought the child into this world, but do you have the time to teach him right from wrong? Share values." She'd probably have said, "I'm too busy, Swami Nuansa. I'm too busy. I feed him. What else do you want me to do? I give him shelter. What else do you want me to do? I have to earn so I can pay his mobile phone bill. I give him a good education. What else do you want me to do? I send him to a good school. The best in town." I'm teaching him so that one day he can migrate, maybe to go to another country, settle down there and become a well sought after professional, top of his profession. That's what I wanted him to do. I want him to become a doctor, an engineer, a scientist, a lawyer, a professor. That's what I want him to become. So I'm too busy. Where do I have the time to take him to the temple? How might you expect me to have the time to sit him down and talk to him about how he spent his day at school today? I ask you, parents, how often do you, when your child gets back from school, sit him or her down over a cup of tea maybe and ask her, "How did you spend your day at school today, Pudha? What happened? How many of you have the time to do that? No one loves your child as much as you do. So when your child is at school, he sat next to, or she sat next to, a child who might have all sorts of problems. Drugs is just one. Do you know how pornography is sweeping across the nation? It's just everywhere. Why? You need the mobile phone. You can't survive without it today, can you? We have become so dumb that we can't exist without a smartphone. I'm not saying we've got to do away with them, because we cannot. It would be impractical of me to even suggest something so absurd like that, to say, well, let's just all switch off our mobile phones and just go back to the ice age. I'm not even suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is, I'm just pointing out a problem. A problem that is rife. A problem that is like cancer. It's eating you from the inside and you don't even know it until one day you just drop dead. And then it's too late. I didn't expect to talk to you about this so soon, but I don't think the world can wait. Drugs, sex, and pornography. It is destroying our youth. By our youth, ladies and gentlemen, I mean your children. Because you don't have the time to think. You don't have the time to think about. You don't have the time to think about your children. Because you're far too busy in your lives. And besides, the things that you have to think about today are not the things that are going to save your children. That's the other main reason. Yes, we need to give our children a good education so that they can compete with the rest of the world, right? We can't take a back step and not compete with the world out there. We need to do that. I agree with all that. But in the midst of all that, we must not forget that if we forget, or if we leave out, if we ignore instilling in our children a value set, virtues, principles, morals, integrity, we will not have a child left to become a doctor. Ask any parent whose child is today in a prison cell and ask them, did you think this was going to happen a year before it did? And they'll say no. Now I ask you, do you think it's going to happen to you? What's the answer? No way, Swami. No answer. No way. I know my child. He's the apple of my eye. I know my child. Okay, for those who think you know your child, let me ask you a question. Did your parents know you? Did your parents know everything you got up to? Did your parents know all the friends you kept? All the secrets that you shared? All the places you went? And I'm talking about when you were a child, perhaps 20 years ago. Things were very different back then. Today, we are so advanced that when we want something, you don't have to wait for it. We talked about this last week. You don't have to wait for it. And everything is so readily available, all you have to do is just press a button. I'm asking you to wake up to the reality that is sweeping across our nation, and unfortunately, your children are in the way. If you don't teach them, to guard themselves, to protect themselves, if you just don't find the time to have that chat with them. I mean, if that's the only thing that you can do, I ask you to do that. When they get back home from school, at least once a week, ladies and gentlemen, please take some time to talk with them and ask them, what did you get up to at school today? This week, how did it go? What did your friend say? What are you talking about? You know, what's going on in school these days? Otherwise, you live to regret. So many parents come and talk to us. So many parents. And you'd think that those parents are parents who are, you know, they struggle to make ends meet. Not necessarily. Let me give you a fact. See if this makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. By this point, in the last 6 years of my monkhood, I have met many people who've come to me as they wanted to suicide, to commit suicide. Young people. When you listen to their stories, to this date, none of them have been stories where they wanted to commit suicide because they were poor. They couldn't make ends meet. They couldn't feed their families. No. Sometimes it was because of the embarrassment caused by their children, because the children went straight. And if you keep on digging, you realize parents just didn't have the time to correct them when it was possible. Some because the children have done drugs. You start doing it, you can't stop it. You know, that is how drugs are designed to work. It becomes an addiction. You can't stop it. Others, they get into relationships. And those relationships, if you don't know how to work a relationship, you shouldn't be in one. If you don't know how to operate a car, you wouldn't get in one, right? But people who have no idea how to work a relationship, they get into one soon after they turn 18. Well, that was in my time. But now, soon after they turn 6? Ask your 6-year-old. Ask your 6-year-old, do you have an affair? She might not know what an affair is. But she'll tell you that there's someone she fancies. Trust me, she won't ask you before she starts that relationship. Please don't think I'm insulting you as parents. What I'm trying to do is to try and save your children. Because, you know, that is everything for you, isn't it? Everything you do, everything you want to do, everything you sacrifice, you do so for your children. I'm saying it's not just enough to teach them, feed them, give them shelter, build them a good future. You need to take care of their minds. Because a mind is an animal on its own, ladies and gentlemen. When the mind wants something, it will go get it, either by hook or by crook. You know this is so because when something got into your mind, you know how you acted. You somehow went and made it happen. When you thought you wanted to be with someone, you made it happen. When you thought you wanted something, you made it happen. At least when you had the choice to make, you had the liberty to make those choices, you were educated enough about the ways of the world. But today, children don't have the time to learn about how things work, but that doesn't stop them from wanting things. See, by the time you had an affair, when you were younger, you'd been in a family, you'd listen to your father, you'd listen to your mother, you'd gotten advice from your uncle. Perhaps, you know, you were 18, 19, 20 at least, 20 years of life experience you had. But now, 6. What do they know about a relationship? I mean, what do they know about friends? Can all friends be trusted? It would be fair to call those who you trust a friend But what happens today is you call them a friend and then you trust them. Every time your trust was broken, it was not from someone who you disliked. It was always from someone who you liked, who you thought was a friend. But they don't teach that in schools. They don't teach that in schools because that is supposed to be taught at home. But what if parents don't have the time? What if parents are far too busy earning for the family, earning for the next relocation, earning for the next house, earning to buy the next property, earning to buy the next car, earning to marry their child off one day, earning for their education? I urge the parents in here, at least those who are fortunate enough to listen to these words, do make sure that you invest a part of your life to bringing up your child. Bringing a child into this world was not the challenge. Anyone can do that. But bringing up your child with the right morals, with the right values, with the right virtues. Because otherwise one day you will come and say, Swami Nivas, my child doesn't even respect me anymore. I'm sick and I'm old and my child doesn't look after me. Then I'll tell you, I told you so. Because then it'll be too late to do anything other than that. But what I'm saying is, you know, bringing up your child and instilling values, virtues and nobility into them is not to be done because they should one day be there to look after you. That seems almost a bit selfish. That's not what I mean. At least, you know, that do it so that one day they can look after themselves. Let alone yours, you, so that they can look after themselves, so that you don't have to worry about them. I mean, think about it, right? Today, parents think by the time that their children are mature, you can marry them off and then, you know, just retire, okay? And just, you know, the two parents, if they're still left alive by that point, you just retire and, you know, just live your life, the last years of your life happily. But the truth is you can't do that because you're still worried about your children. They're having fights between themselves. They're having arguments. So you don't know when they might come home again. Marry the daughter off, but you don't know when she's going to come home again. Saying, Amma, I can't do this anymore. Please take me back. Don't nod. Just give me a virtual nod. You know who I'm talking about. Not you, right? Believe you me, I don't mean any insult by saying this. This is not a criticism. All I'm saying is, let's do the right thing. I only say these words because I care. I care enough that I don't want you to suffer, because you don't have to. You don't need to. If we do the right thing today, we don't have to regret tomorrow. You know, people spend a fortune on a wedding. I've got nothing against that. If you can afford it, do so. You know, some families will be fed. Why not? The people who work there, you know, they'll get a nice bonus at the end of the year. Why not? You work hard and feed them. That's fine. That's not what I've got anything against. But what I'm saying is, people who spend so much of their lives so that they can put up a nice party, a nice wedding, and show it off to the rest of the world, you know, what an embarrassment will it be if 2 weeks later they have to split up. And then they come home, and then now you have to take them back. Now what are you going to say to your next door neighbor? All because You didn't have the time to teach your children. How, in the face of an argument, do you control yourself? How, when someone says something you don't like, how do you face that? How do you control yourself? How do you manage yourself? How do you strengthen your mind enough so that you don't have to fall victim and pray? How do you control your vexations? How do you not be disappointed? How do you not be frustrated? Do you know the number of times people have split up because they couldn't decide whether the toilet seat had to be up or down? It's in the papers. They couldn't agree. That was enough to split the family. If we don't teach our children these things, folks, you know, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. Because as monks, we have nothing better to do, right? We practice the path and we observe what's going on out there, at least from what we get to hear. Because people come and, you know, they just unload all their life's problems in front of us. So we get to experience what life is like without the Dhamma while practicing the Dhamma. It's ironical how that works. Because, that you know, in reality, it is the people who are in the problems who need the Dhamma. But we have the Dhamma, but no problems. It's so funny how that works. It's always like that, isn't it? When you have the money, you don't have the brains. But when you have the brains, you don't have the money. That's always how the world works. You always have something when you don't need it. And when you need it, you don't want it. So it's really interesting to study, you know, how society works and all the problems that people find themselves in. Because, you know, when you have a problem, who do you run to? A mental problem. You know, when you're really down, upset and bothered, right? Even if you don't have the time to go to the temple once a month, right, for on a poya day to observe seal. Why not? Too busy. But when things start going south, when you find out that your mother's been diagnosed with cancer, then where do you take her? Now you remember the temple. When you find out that your child has started doing drugs, now you take him to the temple. When you find out that your daughter is in an illicit relationship, in an affair that she shouldn't be in, now you take her to the temple. Hold her by the hand. No, you're going to meet the monk. Swami Nazar, give her some advice. You know what I do? Do it. Leave the room, please. The person who needs advice is already there. It's too late to give advice to the girl. Now, of course, I don't know half of you in the room, so some of these tales might relate to you. But I don't mean to offend or insult, right? I'm just talking about life. I'm just talking about what people come and share with me. So some of these tales might relate to you. Some of these stories might seem all too familiar. Because you're not the only one. They're all like that. A mind is a mind is a mind. You give yourselves a name, you give yourselves a title, you give yourselves a status, but ultimately it's just a mind. And when problems come, all minds suffer the same. That is why we don't study people, we study minds. We don't study engineers and doctors and lawyers and physicians, we study minds. Our study is the science of the mind. And therefore, you are all part of that. So when things start going bad, that's when people remember the temple. Because when things are happy, where do you remember? Holiday. When things are going fine, right? When the money is flowing in, right? When people are all happy, you know, it's a happy time, good days. Then you remember the holidays. Let's go to New York. Let's go to Manila. Let's go to Hawaii. Let's go to London. Let's travel the world. Let's go to Tokyo. See what's there that we don't have here. Even if it's a trip up to UK, I mean Uzbekistan, even if it's that, it's time to, you know, have a holiday, enjoy. But when things don't go right, when you find out the next problem that has just struck you, the next meteor that has just hit you, now what happens? Now you forget all those glamorous plans and you take the child, you take the wife, you take the husband, you take the mother, you take the father, and you take them to the temple. And then you now sit down and try to work out an answer. Let me tell you this, ladies and gentlemen. I encourage you to stop thinking of the temple as a place where you have to take broken goods to be repaired. That is not what the temple is. It is not a place where you take broken goods to be repaired. It's where you take a mind and fortify it, strengthen it, galvanize it, so it doesn't break, it doesn't rust, it doesn't go brittle. So it's no longer fragile, it's strong, it's upright, it's sturdy, it's rigid and it's robust. That is what the Dhamma is for. I didn't ordain because I had any problems. I didn't enter monkhood because I had a broken relationship. Or I realized that, you know, I got a cancer. Or my father died. None of those were the reasons. Or not because we were poor. None of those were the reasons. I entered monkhood because I realized the truth. Just like when Prince Siddhartha left home, nothing was wrong with him. He had everything going for him. But later on, you know, in this sasana, because of some people who entered robes for the wrong reasons, it started to earn a reputation. Today, if I said, why don't you give your son? Can I take him with me to the monastery? You might be shocked and you might say, Swami, there's nothing wrong with him. There's nothing wrong with him. Why do you suggest that I should give him up? We are a well-to-do family. He's not in a broken relationship. He's not broken-hearted. There's nothing wrong with him. So why should we go to the temple? That's, you know, partly because of the reputation that was built around the sasana. When people entered robes for the wrong reasons. You know, back in the time of the Buddha, all of the Rahatan Mahanses, virtually all of them were princesses. They were kings. They were emperors. They were royals, aristocrats. Right from the Buddha, who was the heir apparent to the throne, Ananda, who was his cousin, Yashodhara, who was the princess, right? They all went into the sasana, not because they had nothing. They had everything and still realized none of it actually matters. That is what the sasana is. I share this with you, ladies and gentlemen, because, you know, be proud of who you are as a Buddhist. And I don't mean Buddhism as a religion. I mean as someone who follows the Buddhist philosophy. If you're a Muslim, by religion, so be it. Go to the mosque every Friday. Do your prayers. It's fine. But as you do that, I invite you to study the Buddhist philosophy. Because this is the science of the mind. If you're a Christian, go to the church. Don't stop doing that. Because that is your duty as a good Christian. You have to do that. And provide for the church. Because that is your duty. Do so. I always tell you, come here empty-pocketed. Come here empty-handed, but leave with a full mind. You don't have to bring anything here. You don't have to bring anything here because people who have come here before you, they started this journey before you. They started walking this path and they realized the truth behind these words. And they transformed. That transformation was so immense, so life-changing, that what they wanted to do from that point forward was, whilst I reap the fruits, these sweet fruits for myself, I want to make this opportunity available for others. How much do you pay to come into this hall and listen to this talk in this nicely air-conditioned room? How much do you pay for that? When there was an invitation for us to start to do this sermon on a Sunday morning in Colombo, we started looking around for venues. Do you know how expensive they are? A venue of this size, with all these facilities, you don't even have to climb the stairs. For heaven's sake. You press a button and it takes you up here. Whether it's hot outside or raining outside, doesn't bother you. And even if you had to skip breakfast to come here, it's fine because at the end of the sermon you get a refreshment. You know how much you'd have to pay to hire a facility like this? Someone looked up a few and then they told me, Swaminasa, I think for a venue of the size that we need for the people that will eventually come to the talks, and to provide them with a refreshment, because that has already also been suggested by the organizers, I think we are going to have to pay out about 70,000 rupees per couple of hours. I said, what? Let's not bother. But then they said, no, Swaminathan, there are people who are willing to pay. I'm like, what? That is what I found most surprising. But then again, it didn't surprise me. After I gave it a second thought, I realized, you know, once you realize the truth, once you realize how much this transforms you, and the joy that this brings, that all the money in the world did not bring you up until this point. Not all the wealth, not all the riches, not all the power, not all the titles in the world brought you this glory, this happiness, this joy. Once you realize that, you're willing to give up anything and everything. So it doesn't surprise me today that people are willing to do that. Are you worried that someone might drive away in your car? The car that you have parked outside? Are you? No. Yes, it's locked, but also there are security guards outside. How much did you pay them? Did you tip them on the way? No. They don't accept that. But you can thank them on the way out. Because before we started coming here, you know, Sunday mornings was just, there was just light duty. Nothing really much to worry about. But now, they have to make sure that every car coming in leaves and that every car coming in is safe to enter the premises. Whilst you're here listening to the sermon, they're out there guarding your car. A bit of metal. That's what I said, you know, nothing in this world we should take lightly. Nothing we receive we must take lightly. That's why gratitude is a virtue. We must always be grateful for what we have. what people are willing to give us. When you leave, thank them. You don't have to thank me for coming, because I come here because I know the value of the Dhamma. You're paying me by the word, and you don't even know it. You're paying me by the word, because I come here for merits, my Nibbana and yours. But thank them, because they don't know, they haven't heard a single word of what I had to say, as yet. But they're out there trying to provide for their families. But until we started doing this program, Sunday mornings were just a walk in the park for them. Just light touch. Then a bit of overtime maybe for some of them. But now they can't do that because they have to be responsible for every car. If something happens to one of your cars, then who's got to be responsible for that? The guards out there. So they're watchful, vigilant. Thank them. You probably already do. I'm just reminding you in case, on the odd occasion you might forget. Make them realize that what they're doing is worth it. The Dhamma should be life transforming, if nothing else, you know. Otherwise it's no point. I always say this should not be a purely academic study. The Dhamma should be something that transforms you. It makes us all better people. Makes us all more kind and gentle. And more thoughtful about others. More respectful. Because I'm sure, you know, when we leave here, there'll be someone who'll come and sweep this place. Before you come here, there'll be someone who sweeps this place, lays the chairs out. All of that is done for you. For what price? Nothing. Don't have to pay a penny for that. All I ask you to be is grateful. That's all. And I'm sure you are. I'm just saying. This is all because of the Buddha. Do you know why we get this all for free? Because of the Buddha. Not because of me. It's because of the Buddha. If I came in here with a pair of trousers and a jacket and said, I have a talk to give, can you give me a free haul? Do you think they will? No. But then I walk in and he's a scientist in a robe. So, that robe belongs to the Buddha. Therefore, okay. In his name, we give you this place. Do your service. So we have a duty. That's why I said at the start, you know, as we bring our palms together in veneration of the Lord Buddha, let us not forget that this is a pledge that we take upon ourselves. We are here for a purpose. I'm sure and I'm dead certain that none of you are here because you've got nothing better to do on a Sunday morning. You're all here with purpose. You're all here because you're looking for something in life. And I've got that to offer you. But I can't give it to you here. Hold, let me throw it to you. Catch it. I can't do that. I can show you how something happened within me and the same can happen for you. I want you, ladies and gentlemen, to enjoy a carefree life as I do. But carefree doesn't mean duty-free. Not as in duty-free at the airport. I mean duty-free as in free of duty. I still have duties, I still have obligations. 450 people take residence at our monastery. I'm responsible for each and every life. I'm responsible for all of them. So, as a family man, I only had myself and my wife to worry about, and maybe my parents, my extended family. But now, not just the children who are there, not just the people who are there, the monks and the anagarikas and the anagarikas who live just a short distance away, but the young children and their families, because they all have expectations to ensure that their children are safe, that their sons and daughters are safe, all that. So I'm not someone who's free of duty, but I'm someone who's free of worry. Would you be up for looking after a family of 450? Would you be up for that and still wear a smile on your face? This is not a fake smile, I promise you. This is as genuine as it comes, I tell you. Trust me. This is not a fake smile. I'm not just coming up here and putting up a smile so that I want you to believe that that Buddhism is true. No. I don't have a worry. I don't have a fear. I'm worryless and I'm fearless. But you have a family of three, maybe four, maybe five, at most. Just think about the amount of worries that burden your shoulders every day. When you come home every day, or when you go into the, when you on a Monday morning, right, when you walk into the office and you sit down on your swiveling chair and you open up your computer and you go, another week. Oh, how I wish I didn't have to be here right now. But I can feel the burden of my family on my shoulders. I have to feed for them, I have to provide for them. Yeah, so do I. But I have a smile on my face. What's the secret? I'm here to share that with you. And the price for that? Free. How much did you pay for your mother's love? Free. The best things in life are free. So the best thing in life, of course, must be free. The best thing in life is the secret to happiness. It doesn't need to be a secret though. It doesn't need to be a secret. You know, amongst us, it doesn't need to be a secret. Once I share it with you, it's no longer a secret. When my teacher shared it with me, it was no longer a secret. So we pass it on. That is how the noble lineage works. We pass it on. It is not in the Tripitaka though. You can't open a book and read it in there. You can read the theory, but how you actually apply into your lives, that has to come from person to person. It has to go from by word of mouth. As I share this with you today, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure that you will one day with somebody else. Maybe it's with one of your siblings. Perhaps it's your children. Do you remember the day you gave your child a smartphone as parents? Did that not worry you? I mean, if it didn't worry you, you're not parents. When you introduce your child, actually you didn't introduce your child to Facebook, they probably introduced you to Facebook. I should be careful with what I say. When your son introduced you to Facebook, and he showed you, these are all my friends on Facebook. Look at all these messages that I can receive. Look at all these profiles that I can like. And look at all these friend invites that I get. Look at all these videos that I can watch on the wall. You know that there's no such thing as a free lunch, right? If something's free, what's being sold? If you get something for free, what's being sold? You. You are the commodity. That is why it's free. Meaning, your time is sold. What is the most priceless thing for you? What is the thing that you can't earn once you've spent it? People think it's money. That's the thing. People think it's money. So they're so careful about their money. Every year, don't you do a money budget? I used to have that as a good habit. My mentor taught me to do that. So important to have a mentor in life. Have your parents, have your teachers, have a mentor. A mentor who will guide you. Someone who's successful, someone who's where you want to be. A mentor. My mentor taught me, budget. But he said, don't just budget your money. Budget something that is more precious than money. Something when you spend, you can never earn it back. Have you heard the saying, time is money? What a load of rubbish. If time is money, ladies and gentlemen, you should be able to give one and take the other. Can you? You can give your time and earn money. Shall I give you back the money and or will you return the money to me and shall I give you back your time? 60 long years you will spend working for someone and they'll give you money. Yeah? At the end of the 60 years you decide, you know what? That was a waste of my time. I want to do something else with those 60 years. Right? Go back and return the money. Every penny of it. Are they going to give you 60 years back? Is it fair to say then that time is money? Don't fall for that nonsense. I'm here to empower you to make the right decisions and right choices in your lives. I know where you are because I've been there. I know where you're heading because I was heading that way. I'm not belittling you by any means. And please don't feel that way either. From time to time you might feel, you know, Swami Nivas is a bit snobbish. He's sitting on his high seat even, and talking down to us. No, that is not true. You arranged this before I got here. If you could look into my mind, I'm prepared for any of you just come and walk over me. That's perfectly fine. I'm prepared for any of you to just come and have a piece of your mind that, you know, in fact, when you have a problem at home, right, if you have an argument and you really want to get a piece of your mind out, you want to tear a new page, you want to have a go at your wife or your husband or your child, don't do it with them. Come and do it with me. I'm okay with that. Because you just have a frustration, you want to vent, come and do it with me. I'm okay with that. I'm okay to just be walked over. That's fine. All of this is because of the Dhamma, not because of me. This decorations, you know, this, all of this, this, the decoration that you see here, all of this is for the Dhamma. Not for me. That's why no matter who, which Swami Nivasa comes here, you'll still do the same, won't you? So it's not for this Swami Nivasa. If another Swami Nivasa walked in one of these days, sits down and starts giving a talk, wouldn't you worship him the same? If a Mehanin Mahansi comes here and does a sermon, wouldn't you worship her the same? Wouldn't you arrange this place the same? Then is it for me? Any of this? Of course not. It's for the Dhamma, and I know that. I want you all to be able to live as happy a life as I do, but with all the duties and responsibilities fulfilled. And all you need to do for that is to understand the Dhamma. Your understanding, your realization of the Dhamma will free you. Because what I offer you, ladies and gentlemen, is a choice of freedom. So whilst you're out there fighting for the freedom of choice, no matter what it might be, right? You might sometimes fight for the freedom to park your car in a car parking space. You'll find yourself making that fight. Right? I should have the choice to park here because this is my driveway, someone might say. I should have the choice to build up my house and add another story to it or add an extension to it because it's my house. So you'll go fighting for that. You'll go to the local council and fight with the councillors. See, you're fighting for the freedom of choice. When you set your mind on someone and you want to be with that person for the rest of your life, you'll fight with your parents. You'll fight with her parents or his parents. Right? Somehow to make that freedom of choice. When you go to the shop and you want to buy something and you think it's too expensive, what do? You try and negotiate. It's too expensive. Give me a better price. Again, you're fighting for the freedom of choice. When you want something and someone says it's booked, I'm afraid, what do you say? Surely we can make something happen. Surely you can make an adjustment for me. Surely something can be done. Ask your boss to come here, I want to talk to him. Ask your manager to come here, let me go and talk to him. See, you're fighting for the freedom of choice. Carry on your fight, that's fine. But what I ask you to do is, let's also fight for the choice of freedom. the choice of freedom. All I'm here to do is lay down all those choices in front of you. You're free to make your own choice. So far, you've all been making the freedom of choice, but not the choice of freedom. What is the choice of freedom? Is our next question then. What is the choice of freedom? The choice that offers you freedom. Do you remember from last week? I told you, I asked you this question. Why do you outsource your happiness to others? If I asked you now, ladies and gentlemen, could you not name me five things or five people that could upset you right now? Five things that could upset you, that could bother you? Where do we start? You'll say, wherever, Swami answered. We can start wherever. Five things or five people that can upset you. Your work, your boss can upset you. You ask for something, they say no. They ask you to do something you don't like, but you have to. Your clients can upset you. Right? You say, please sign the dotted line, sir. No, I want to discuss further how I can get a better price. No, not again. We've been through this. What about at home with your spouse? Or have you just become too accustomed to it now that it just doesn't seem like a fight anymore? Same battle over and over and over again. But you know the drill, right? Yes, now you've gotten used to it, and you know now the things you have to say and the things you shouldn't be saying, right? But it was a case of you scratch my back, I scratch yours. You know all this stuff. I'm not making this up, am I? Isn't family life like this? You can't lie to me because I've been there, done that. I've been there, done that, so I know what it's like. When she says, let's paint the walls blue, and you don't like blue, now what happens? Someone has to give in. I mean, living together is living making compromises, is it not? When you compromise, what do you compromise? Your suffering or your happiness? You're compromising your happiness. Think about the last time you had a brawl at home, an argument. So it might have been something as simple as, excuse me, same thing for dinner again. Have you never had a verbal war at home? Where your words are your weapons? Sometimes you say things that are so sharp and so piercing, and you know it. And you pretend like nothing happened. And just in passing you say, yeah, my father said this would happen. Yeah, you always have it your way. Why can you never see things from my perspective? It's okay. It's all right. And don't nod because you think I'm going to embarrass myself and my family by nodding. So don't nod. But I know that we are all in the same boat. It's okay because life is such. You know, who are we kidding? Life is such. You know, when you leave home, you wear a smile on your faces, don't you? Where do you hang that smile? By the door? You have a mask, don't you? By the door. And you put it on before you leave. Let's just pretend that nothing's wrong. Nothing's going on between us. Let's just pretend that we don't have any misunderstandings, any arguments. So, right? Okay, maybe something's going on. Someone, you hear a knock on the door. Right? Right. Go wash your face. Go wash your face. Stop crying. Stop crying already. Someone's at the door. Go and get the door. I And don't you be saying anything. And then they walk in and go, hello, Mr. and Mrs. How are you doing? Never been better. Who are we kidding? But the thing is, you know, people who just walk in through the door, they also know. Because at home, it's the same story. Same story. So where is that happiness that you were promised? On the Magul Porul. Where was that promise? What's happened to that promise? Were those promises kept? Or how long were the promises kept? We started talking about the reason behind some of these things last week. How absence makes the heart grow fonder. See, when you first started out, right? Now, let's try and remember some of the things we talked about last week. When you first started out, it was just a fling. When it was just that first furtive glance, right? A wink. Or maybe just a smile, just a, you know, it was just an attraction, which then grew into an appeal, and then maybe later on into affection. You were apart. You didn't get to see much of each other. You had to wait until class every Saturday. Saturday afternoon you had that class and you had to wait until you met her. He had to wait until you meet. Or maybe you lived in two countries, worlds apart. Or maybe you lived in another town somewhere. And that meeting only happened once every few weeks. Maybe once a week at best. At that time, you know, the time that you had to spend apart from each other was time that you were building up inside. The expectation of meeting them. That longing, that needing to see them, that longing to see them was building up inside, and that is what you experienced as vexation. So when the meeting happened, you were relieved. That relief was what you experienced as pleasure, because what the eye wishes to see, when the eye sees it, the eye experiences pleasure. We talked about cake last week, remember? Why is this that the most favorite cake, your most favorite cake, you can't have every day? As much as it might be the most delicious thing in the world, but the more you eat it, the more you get fed up of it. Now we were starting to build up a theory around why these things happen. When you live apart from each other, right, that builds in your mind that looking forward to feeling. And then when you look at them, when you finally meet, there's no longer looking forward to. I often relate this experience when I used to live in England. I had to travel quite a bit from Scotland to London and through work. So every week, once every one or two weeks, I always found myself at the airport. And the arrivals lounge is a fantastic place to observe how this vexation and release from vexation and pleasure works. It's fantastic. So you'll have seen this if you've had any traveling. When two people meet, in the arrivals lounge, and you can tell how long they've been apart from each other, can't you? Can you not? When you see two people meet, can you not tell how long they've been apart from each other? How do you say that? How do you say it? How do you tell? Come on. Don't be shy. What is, you know, the greeting that they receive is directly proportional to what? How far they've been apart. So if it's just a simple handshake, or just a simple, so you arrived safely, right, let's go. How far have they been, how long have they been apart? Maybe just a day or two. Just a day or two. What if it's about a month? They've been apart for a month. There's at least going to be a hug in there, right? At least a hug. Agree? Yeah, there's at least going to be a hug. I mean, a month apart and no Skyping in between. No Skyping, right? Month apart, not a word spoken, right? And then reunion after a month. How do you normally greet them? At least a hug and maybe a peck on the cheek, right? A bouquet of flowers? No, that's too soon, isn't it? You got to wait at least 3 months for some flowers. What about when you start going into 6 month periods, like maybe a year apart, to maybe several years? What then? Do you think they stop at a hug? Just some flowers? Now then it becomes roll on the floor time, right? Hugs and embraces and kisses and tears of joy. You just can't get enough of them. I mean, if the security guards weren't there, one would swallow the other so much. The embracing that goes on, the hugging and the kissing, and it's like sometimes people, you know, get a room, guys. Why? Think about it. Why is it the longer you are apart, the better or the higher, the greater the pleasure when there is reunion? I have more to say. When you go home, now say let's take the spouses, right? Husband or wife, they've been apart for, say, a year in another country. Not much of keeping in touch with each other either. It was not possible. Now it's been a year. They've come back and they've gone back home. What do you think is going to be on the menu for lunch that day? They've been apart for a year. What do you think is going to be in the menu? Cup of tea? Their favorite dish? Yeah? Favorite dish. What do you think about their room? Do you think they'll be asked to make it up, or do you think the room will be made up for them? I mean, there are wives here. If your husband has ever done any traveling, right, and when they get back home, how do you prepare your home for their arrival? Or husbands here, when their wife has had to travel and they come back home, how do you prepare for her arrival? Or maybe mothers and fathers here, when your child goes away, maybe for study, 2 or 3 years, right, in another country, do their study, they come back home. On the first day, how do you greet them? How do you treat them? Tell me. Just a cup of tea? You give them the royal treatment, don't you? The royal treatment? And you give them, like, you know, when you walk into the room, that's like the presidential suite of a hotel room. All of the amenities, the bed made, nice and fragrant, their favorite meal cooked, nice and warm, even the hot water bottle is filled with water, and there are cars, there are maybe balloons and flowers and everything. So that is how the first day happens, right? And when now they have to use the washroom, how's the washroom? Spick and span, is it not? And the towel, all washed neatly and kept aside. And, you know, to wear after the wash, the new clothes, yeah? New clothes for this loved one who's returned after a long time. Now, this is the first day. Let's fast forward time. Let's come to the second or the third day. What happens then? Same treatment? Is it the same treatment? On the second or the third day? So the first day you made them a cup of tea and you asked them, would you like me to make some soup for you for the evening? Is there anything else you'd like me to get for you? And all that. But on the second or the third day, I mean, I'm sharing this story so you don't fall into this trap. Don't buy this nonsense. Do it, but don't fall for it. Realize that all of this is not because they love you so much. It's all because they love themselves so much. They couldn't bear not seeing you for all this time. And now they have just seen you. The longing and the waiting and the frustration and the disappointment and the urge and all that vexation that was building up inside of them has been relieved. Because truly, ladies and gentlemen, if it was because they loved you, shouldn't they be giving you the royal treatment every day? Shouldn't they be giving you the royal treatment every day? But do you get it? Of course not. So you can't say this is because my family loves me so much. If it's love, then it has to be every day. But it's not like that. I'm not saying your family doesn't love you. Yes, they do. Fine. But what I'm saying is, there's another thing at play here. So when it comes to the second or the third day, right? The first day they say, shall I make a cup of tea for you? And now they say, if you're going to make a cup of tea, can you make one for me as well, please? If you're going to put the kettle on, I'd like one too, please. And then say a week later, do you think they come and make the bed for you every day? Now what they might say is, you know, if you're making the bed, then can you make mine as well, please? If you're doing the washing, here's mine as well. It's in the laundry basket. So what happened? You know, this is life. So in the lab of life, you have experienced all this. Now I need you to apply the Dhamma and work out what's going on. Why is this? So we said, absence makes the heart grow fonder. In your absence, there was the waiting. The waiting had to happen. The longing for you. The vexation to be with you, all of that was building up in their minds. But as you met, that vexation was relieved. It was, imagine like pressure inside a pressure cooker. Right? As it heats up, what happens to the pressure inside? It builds up, right? So the pressure builds up. And at some point, you open the lid and then the pressure is released. The same thing happens in life. All that first-class treatment, all that royal treatment was because there was a vexation that was in their minds which was relieved on that first meeting. And then after that, that vexation was no longer. So therefore, there was no need to give you that kind of treatment. Now you would be foolish to fall for it. You just need to understand it. I'm not saying from here on don't treat your family like that. Do so. But I'm saying if you are the member of the family who gets this treatment, realize what's really going on. Understand what's really going on. But if another member of your family goes away, and when they come back, treat them the same. We're not about changing what we do on a day-to-day basis. We do the same things. We just understand it differently. We realize things differently. We perceive things differently. But do the same things. It's fine. Because there's no harm in making someone happy, is there? If you can make someone happy as they return by giving them a box of chocolates, by giving them a bouquet of flowers, by, you know, giving them a really warm hug, if that makes them happy, then what's wrong with that? Do so. I just need you to do it, but know what else is going on. So do it mindfully. Do it mindfully. Mindfully aware of what's really going on. Do it nonetheless. So that's just another example. Whenever you need something, ladies and gentlemen, you know, whenever you really, really need something, you long for it. And the more you long for it, the more there's a build-up. The more there's a build-up, the more there is pain inside. And you know this feeling when you just can't wait for something to happen. And that build-up is released at the point that you are met with that object of your wanting. So why is it that I am happy today and I don't go through this cycle of waiting for something to happen and then it happens and then I'm relieved of it? Why do I not go through that experience now? For one reason alone. I have understood the mechanism of pleasure. And you will soon, if you haven't already. When you understand the mechanism of pleasure, and that pleasure is nothing other than the relief from pain, you no longer look forward to the pain. You no longer look forward to that. It doesn't stop you from doing it, because you do it, you know, conventionally it's what we got to do. We got to be nice people. We got to be polite. We got to be welcoming. We got to be hospitable. Right? We have to have our good manners about us. We have to meet and we have to greet. We do all that. So outwardly, the same things. Our behaviors don't change. Our actions don't change. What changes is the way we think about it. See, the ultimate goal of all this, ladies and gentlemen, is simply for me to help you to relieve yourself from any suffering that you get yourselves into. That's it. If you can tell me, yes, Swaminand, that has now happened, we no longer need these talks. We can pack up and go home. And you can live your lives as you normally have done and do this. It's the same regular things you've always done. It's perfectly fine. At the end of these talks, whenever, right, if today is the last day you're going to come, I don't expect you from now on to go and stop looking after your family or stop going to work or stop your education or anything like that. Carry on doing whatever you have to do. Carry on doing whatever you got to do. Be a good mother, be a good father, be a good son, a daughter, be a good student, be a good teacher, be a good citizen, be a good employee, an employer. Do all of those things. All I'm asking you to do is you carry the burden of it in your mind. Your heart weeps. That is what I have a problem with. If you have a sleepless night because you're trying to be a good mother, that doesn't compute. There's nothing about being a good mother and suffering on behalf of her children. Be the former, but don't let the latter happen. Suffering is only a product of attachment. Nothing else. It would be wrong to say that I love my children so deeply, that's why when I see them hurt, I cry. Complete and utter nonsense. Don't fall for that. Don't think that as a good mother, your expression of love are the tears that swell up in your eyes when you see that they suffer. That is not a mother's love. In which case, the Buddha never loved anybody. But for 45 long years of his life, he walked on foot, preaching the Dhamma, going from door to door, going from town to town and village to village, healing people, healing mothers, healing fathers, healing sons and daughters, healing kings and beggars, teaching them true happiness. True happiness is not crying when the person you love has a problem, but it is neither being in a state of euphoric joy when someone you love is in a state of happiness. It's neither of those things. It's being unshakable. It's being equanimous. It's neither here nor there. It's neither of these two extremes. Let me give you more examples to help you work out why this pleasure that you experience in life is just so overrated and why I urge you not to fall into this trap. Let me give you another example. I'm going to ask you a question, okay? And I want you to give me some answers. Let's say there's a mother. She has two children. Okay, let's say they're identical twins. Just to give a level playing field. Okay? Because otherwise you might say, you know, I like my elder son because he was the first. I like him better. All right. So, twins, identical twins, right? And they're both in the same class, in the same school. It's exam time. Now, one of these children, they're more studious than the other. Okay, one of them is more studious than the other. So the studious child, he always gets top grades in class. So he's usually the first, second or third in class. Whereas the other, they are sort of average. They're the more sporty type. Okay, so maybe they're usually 15 and below. 15, 16, that sort of rank at school. So end of term exams or end of year exams, they come home with the results and they say, Mother, we have got our results. And you ask him, yes, Puta, tell me, what did you get? So the boy who always comes top in class says, guess what? I've come first in class today. So he's always like first, second or third in class. What is your reaction to this child? Do you throw a party? He's always first, second or third in class. Okay, every term exam, he comes first, second or third. He's never dropped below that. And he comes home and says, I'm first in class, Mother. What might you do? At best, now you pat his head and say, well done, Buddha, you know. You make our family proud. Well done again. You might give him a hug. Now the second child, he's not very studious. He's always 15th or so. He comes and says, Mother, guess what? I'm third in class. What do you do now? Do you give the second child the same treatment that you gave the first child? What do? You're over the moon, aren't you? If you could, you'd carry him and throw him up in the air just to express the joy that has just taken over your heart. Why so? Why is this? Is coming third better than coming first? Is coming third better than coming first? Of course not, because you like it when your child comes first in class. But this second child, like the other twin, he's usually 15th in class. Now he comes home and says he's third in class, but you give him a better reaction. You smother him with love and affection in ways that you never have done the other child who always comes first, second or third in class. Now I want you to answer me. Why this unfairness? Madam, absolutely. Why this unfairness? And the answer to that is, whatever vexed you more, that is what gave you the more pleasure. With the first child, you knew that he was always going to come first in class, first, second or third in class. So therefore, there was not a great deal of expectation. Now, you always knew that was going to happen. So there was not a lot of vexation. There was not a lot of, might he fail again? There was not a lot of that. But with the second child, you were always worried about your second child. Is he not going to perform in class any day? He's always coming middle in class. You know, I don't know, at this rate, he might just, drop out of school one of these days. He's not performing very well. He's not the pride of our family. How can I talk about him to my friends? But today he comes and says, I'm third. That is going to be the reason for the next party. You know you go through these emotions. Perhaps you never stop to wonder why. See, so much so that the first child thinks, flippy neck. I come first in class every week, or every month, every term, and I don't get this kind of treatment. I know what I have to do next time. He's going to start underperforming at school, just so he can get your love the same way as his brother did. Because you've just treated them very unfairly. Of course, it's unfair to them, but it's fair to you. Because what you decide is fair is all based on what you vex about, what you suffer about, what your expectation is about. This is the truth. See, just time and time again, I'm throwing at you examples, ladies and gentlemen, to prove to you the point that pleasure is not something you get from a person or an object or an event or a situation. It's something that, you know, pleasure is not a state of mind. It's an activity of mind. That's why you're always trying to be happy but never happy. We talked about this last week. You can only be one of these two things. You can either try to be happy or you can be happy. You can't be both. You walk into a restaurant for a difference, for a change, because you're trying to be happy. If that made you happy, you don't need to be made happy again. But you do. That's why after a nice hearty meal, you have to have, you know, after a nice hearty main course, you also need the side course. And you need the dessert. Because you were not made happy by the first meal. I used to be like that. My wife and I, we used to love going to restaurants. Every weekend we'd do that. If it was not a movie night at home, we'd go out. We wanted to try new things. We would drive across London to get to the best ice cream parlor. We did. We'd drive across the city to get to try the best shish kebab. We did. We did. But today I'm not fussed. I'm not fussed because it's not because I've kind of forced myself into, you know, it's all the same thing, why do I bother? No, it's not that. Today I don't seek delight, I don't seek pleasure from food. Because pleasure is not in the food. That's why I don't seek it in food. For as long as you believe that the pleasure that you experience when you eat a piece of cake comes from the cake, you'll always try to keep eating cake, but you will never be satisfied. Are you ever satisfied eating cake? Are you? Can you have a piece of cake and say, that's it, I don't need to eat cake again? That's the last piece of cake ever? No. You'll always try it again. Maybe after a week, maybe after 2 weeks. After a while, you'll always try it again because you're never content. You're not content, ladies and gentlemen, because you don't know how to be content. It's not your fault. Oh, it's only because you've never learned how to. I'm here to show you how. Talking about food, now you started offering alms into this alms bowl. So the Swami says when they start going on Pindapatha. Right? I need to get something off my chest. I need you all to give the gift of giving. Do you understand what that is? The gift of giving? It's not giving. It's the gift of giving. Now that's not to say you should stop giving. You can. The reason that we go on an alms round is because there are lots of innocent people out there who, if a Swaminarayana didn't visit them, they would never have the means or even the thought to go to a temple, to go to a monk and offer something to them. They don't have half of what you have. Today you enjoy the privileged lives that you do, and please don't think I'm making any presumptions, but in many ways you'll be more privileged than most of them. So I'm not stereotyping anyone, I'm just saying, so please don't be offended. But what I'm saying is in many ways, right, you are more privileged than most of them. You're here today, ladies and gentlemen, because you have given. That is why today you receive. Whatever you enjoy today, you enjoy because these are the fruits of the seeds that you sowed. So be happy about that. Rejoice in everything you have today. It's because you've given. What you give is what you get. But there are many people out there, they don't have the means to give. And so they have a poor man's mindset. So they'll never do a dana. They probably won't invite a Swami Nuhansi to their home, as you might do, and offer them an alms. Offer them any alms. They'll probably never go to the temple and take alms food and offer to the Swami Nuhansi. They probably never do that. What we try to do is to take ourselves there so it makes it easier for them to engage in that charitable deed. But it's becoming more and more difficult to do that because you're filling up the alms bowl before we leave this place. So it's becoming a new habit now. So I'm not asking you to stop. I don't want to deprive you of that opportunity. Do engage in that. But when you do so, all I ask you to do is just offer a little bit of whatever you want to offer. And it matters not what you want to offer. Excuse me. In some homes, when we go to, you know, people are very poor. Very poor. Some of their houses are probably as big as this stage. The entire house, sometimes half of it. Because I asked the driver to take us where people have little to give. So we don't drive into Colombo 7. So you'll probably never meet me there. You meet me here, that's enough, is it not? Right? But we go where people have very little to give. And that is one reason why I want to leave as soon as we are done here. Because I have to finish my meal by 12. Last week, we had to wait outside the lady's house about, I think, for the best part of 5 minutes. Because she could hardly see. I think she was half blind. So she was outside, you know, in her little shanty house. She was tending to something. I think she had a small garden. If you could call that a garden. She had some plants she was growing outside, and she couldn't see us there. We were, what, like 5 yards away from each other, and she couldn't see me. Right until she finished what she was doing, and she walked up to me, and she was standing right in front of my face, and then, oh, Swami Nuhansi. Until then, she couldn't see me. Very poor people. And then she went inside, and she brought half a kimbula banis, and she dropped it into the alms bowl. Maybe that's what she had to eat for the whole afternoon. First she brought a whole one, and then I said, there's one Swami Nuhansi behind me, madam. So she cut it in half, and one in my bowl and one in the other Swami Nuhansi's bowl. So sometimes we have to wait a few minutes out there just so that they get the chance to do that. We stand there just waiting. Some people might think, these Swami Nuhansis, they're so adamant, they won't leave until they get something. You know, the truth is, folks, thanks to people like you, I don't actually have to go on an alms round. If I invited you to offer alms, excuse me, if I invited you to offer alms to the Swami Nuhansi is coming here on a Sunday morning, right, you will treat us like kings. You know, it'll never be enough for you. Whatever you offer, you'll say, no, have some more Swami Nuhansi. I have a little bit more Swami Nuhansi. I have a little bit more to offer Swami Nuhansi. You know how when you offer alms, you know how you are like, right? So we don't go on an alms round because we want to receive. We go on an alms round because we want to give. In some homes, we stop by and they have nothing to offer. And I sometimes say, sir, might you have a spoonful of sugar? I've learned the right words to use. Because once I said, do you have some sugar? And he went and brought a bag full of sugar. I said, no sir, a spoonful of sugar to eat now. And then they go back in and they bring it. Most of the places they think they are here for money. Again, because of what's happening these days. I'm not saying whether any of that is right or wrong. I'm just saying, most places we go to, people will bring some money. And, I, you know, for some people, money is everything. Right? They love their money more than they love their mothers. Some people. If they could earn a fair few pennies, they might sell their mothers on. Some people are like that. It's a dog eat dog world here today. Money is everything now. People have forgotten the value of merits and goodness and virtues and values and morality. Right? So the thing is this, when we walk out, some people actually close their doors because they think we are here for their money. And then you have to wait until someone behind us says, no, the Swami nonsense don't want money. And then they open the door again. So I have to wait until they open the door. For that, I need a few minutes. So that's why I want to get out of this place as soon as possible. Not because I don't like you. Because I want you to give the gift of giving. I want you to rejoice in this. From time to time, I'll come and share some of the stories that we experience when we go out on alms round. Oh, all sorts. Some I won't tell you just yet. Some I'll tell you later. One place we went to, they knew the Swami Nivasa was out there. And no, I won't say that today. Some other day. Because I don't know how much of this you can actually bear. That's why I'm not going to share that story today. Another day maybe. Because I know the devotion that you have towards the Mahasangha. And so, in fact, if I said some of these stories, you'll say, no, Swami Nansa, we won't allow you to go on alms round again. I know what you're like. It's okay, it's all safe, right? So, I'm not a fool to put myself into any unnecessarily risky situations. But, you know, from time to time, we experience. But that is all part of this. We are not going there for the adventure. Trust me. I'm not going there for an adventure. I'm going there to take them on an adventure. The adventure that you are on right now. You're here today because one day, someday, you made that jump. You gave a sadhukara one day. Perhaps it was to the Buddha. Perhaps it was for a Maharatan Mahanse. Perhaps you saw Rahatan Mahase going on alms and someone else offered something and you saw that and you said, Ane Sadhu. That's all you said. And here you are today. You know, let's open that gateway to many other people. Because where we live, we don't really get a chance to do much of that. But out here, there are many poor people. Many poor people. You know this stuff, right? Yeah, I don't need to tell you how many poor people are out there. There are so many poor people. They are poor because they've never given. Or they've only given very little. So we must encourage them to give. Not everything they have to their names. Just a spoonful. That's enough. But to make that spoonful count, you know what I do? I practice the Dhamma. Because there are two ways in which a merit, the gravity, the power of a merit, meritorious deed, can be magnified. One, it is in the intention with which you give. And two, the virtuousness, the morality, the wisdom of the receiving party. How pure they are. That is why the same person giving a spoonful of rice to a sotapanna and someone giving a spoonful of rice to a Maharatan Mahanse, the same person, from the same bowl, with the same spoon, the second spoon earns them much more merits than the first. Because a Rahatan Mahanse is as pure can be. Whereas a Sotapanna is someone who is just making a start on that journey. So that's what I do. I cleanse myself. So that when I go out in service, no matter what people can offer, however little it might be, I can help magnify the merits for them. That is what you all need to do as well. So, when the Swami Nuha says, start going on their arms round, offer. I don't want to deprive any of you of that opportunity. If you wish to offer, then do offer. But offer little so that you don't feel the arms bowl by the time I've left the premises. Because last week we had that problem. You know, because I don't want to take more food than I can consume in that day. And I have little time to take it. By the time the clock hits 12, I have to stop. So even if I'm hungry, I have to stop. But I don't want to throw any food away either. Because, you know, food is not something we should throw away. Someone's worked hard for it, either to earn it or to cook it or to prepare it, right? So it should not be something that should be thrown away. But if you want to offer something, offer a little amount of it. You don't have to throw a whole cake into it. You know, one piece or even half a piece is fine. If you get a piece of cake, I encourage you, you know, don't ask for another one to offer to the Swami Nuhansay. I don't know what you do, I'm just suggesting. Take your piece and split it in half. The first half, you keep it to a side to offer to the Swami Nuhansay, you can have the other half. And if there are two Swami Nuhansays, you know the half that you set aside for the Swami Nuhansay, split that in half. So now you put a quarter into one Swami Nuhansay's bowl and the other quarter into another Swami Nuhansay's bowl. And while you do that, rejoice in it. Because merit is not in the action, it's in the intention. You don't have to offer everything you have to earn a tremendous amount of merit. You just need to have a pure intention. Cetanaham bhikkave kammam vadami. So it's not the action that earns you merit. It is simply the intention, your volition, the devotion that you have. Oh, this is the Mahasangha who represent the Buddha. And the lineage of the great elders who have walked the surface of this earth. People, men and women who travel the world carrying the Buddha's message of freedom. Carrying the Buddha's message of loving kindness and compassion. Oh, how we wish there were more people like this. Not people like me. I mean people like the Mahasangha. With that intention, you can make that offering. And also, make the offering with the intention in mind that may whatever I have offered today help the Swami Nuhansay to practice the path so that I can use it for nothing else than practicing the path. May the Swami Nuhansay use this to practice the path. May it help him in his focus. May it help him in his concentration. May it help him to develop his wisdom, to give him vitality and energy to practice the path. And go on to attain arahathood as soon as he possibly can. With that intention, make your offering. So does it have to be a large quantity? No. Am I asking you not to do it? Not at all. I don't want to deprive any of you of that opportunity because, you know, you have earned it, ladies and gentlemen. You have earned it. Make an offering. It doesn't, so that you don't fill the alms bowl, so that by the time we set out here, I can't go to more than one or two homes. Last week, I think by the time we went to four houses, the alms bowl was full. I had to turn around and come back again. And chances are, we'll never walk that street again. Because there are far too many streets out there, far too many alleyways for one man to cover in his entire lifetime. So for as long as I can come here on a Sunday, and for as long as my teacher gives me permission to do so, I will go on the alms round in the little time that I have between the time I finish the sermon here and 12 noon. I can do that service to people. They don't have what you have today. They are not here listening to the sermon. They're probably watching TV right now. Or maybe they're just, you know, trying to make ends meet. They're probably struggling with their family problems. Maybe they're having a fight right now. Maybe husband and wife having a fight. Mother and children having a fight. We get to hear those things some of the time. But you know what a Swami Nuhansay with an alms bowl and a rope can do? He can stop a fight. Because as we walk and they see us, the fight stops. And then both parties quarreling. A moment before we went there, they both stop their fight. They both stop the argument and they both rush to find, to go and try and find something they can come and offer. And then sometimes the wife says, "Here, here, take this, you go and offer it." And the husband says, "Yeah, you also take half, you go and offer it." See, now we have resolved the conflict. All I had to do was stand there outside their home with the alms board, saying nothing, but saying everything. Our fight is a silent fight. Our fight is a silent fight. I want you to rejoice in that. I'm sharing these stories with you, ladies and gentlemen, and I will share more as we come across more of them. You know, the first day we visited here, none of you were here. That was when we first came here to see the venue and to make sure that you are going to be comfortable here. That was the first time we did an alms round in Colombo, in that part of Colombo. The first offering was made by a poor family, mother and her two children. They were kindergarten age, if not younger. I think maybe 3 or 4 or 5, something like that. 3 or 4, I think. A brother and a sister. And their afternoon meal is what they get from the Montessori. That is their afternoon meal. So when they saw the Swami Mahansi stood outside, the mother came out and said, "Swami Mahansi, sorry, we don't have anything to offer you." And then I said, "Madam, might you maybe have a spoonful of sugar?" And then she went back, "Let me see if I can find some." So she went back. And then the two children saw us. So I could hear the conversation. And then the children saying, "We have the food we got from the Montessori." So now, then after that, I couldn't hear anything. Maybe the mother was making sure that actually they wanted to do this, because perhaps if they offered that, they would have nothing else for the afternoon. But somehow, a few moments later, they came out, the boy and the brother and the sister, with those little bags in their hand. And so they walked outside. They stood in front of the Swami Mahansi with the bag in hand and looking at the alms bowl and looking at the bag again, looking at the alms bowl, looking at my face, looking at the mother's face. I'm trying to work out, should I not? Am I ready for this? Well, that was a big leap for them. Perhaps the first time they've offered anything like that to a monk. You know, for you, offering something like that is like, you know, it's not a second thought. But for them, that is everything for them. You know, that is what matters. That's why I say, merit is not in the item that you offer, ladies and gentlemen. It's how much you are able to give up. It's not the quantity you offer. It's not the size of what you offer. It's how much you give up in your mind. Those children had, that's all they had to eat. So they had a sandwich and a cutlet and a banana. That was their package that they got for lunch. So he opens up the bag, takes up the sandwich, looks at my face, looks at the sandwich again, looks at the mother's face, and he puts it into the alms bowl. And then the hand goes again back into the bag, and out comes the cutlet. And he's wondering, is he going to go? Is he going to be here for the cutlet also? And then he puts the cutlet in again. And now only the banana left. Without giving him more time to think about it, he puts the banana back into the bowl. He puts the banana into the alms bowl. I think he was worried that if he'd given himself more time to think about it, he might walk away with it. So without giving him any time to think about it, he puts the banana into the alms bowl. And his sister followed suit with the Swami who was behind me. And that was their offering. It seems like they've only offered little, but what have they offered? A huge lot. A great deal. They've offered everything. All I had to do was go and stand outside with the alms bowl. I mean, that's a little price. That's a small price to pay, isn't it? If my little legs can carry me there, and if I have my alms bowl with me, if this can do so much, then why not? You are here today, you have what you have today, ladies and gentlemen, because you have given. That is the reason. You have earned this. So you don't need to be embarrassed about what you have. Never be embarrassed about what you have. Never be. And don't let anyone foul mouth you about it. Don't let anyone say, oh, those people, they have. They have no. Don't let anyone discredit you for what you have. I mean, let them say what they want to say. You don't have to go shut their mouths. But don't ever feel embarrassed about what you have. If you have all the wealth in the world, I say, well done. Well done, you. Well deserved. If you have all the riches and luxuries that life can afford you, I say, well done and well deserved. Sometimes when we walk past, you know, big houses and some like palaces, I look at them and go, sadhu, sadhu. You know why I say sadhu? Because I know to get that, they've given something great. I rejoice in what they might have given to earn something like that. I'm sharing this with you lest you forget how you earned what you have earned. Never forget how you earned what you earned. Never forget your beginnings. So the Buddha never discouraged charity. The Buddha never discouraged meritorious deeds. He always said, monks, he spoke to monks and he said, bhikkhus, go ahead and engage in as many meritorious deeds as possible. So what is there to be said about the lay community? Engage in any and every meritorious deed that you possibly can. Of course, do it wisely, right? Have your wits about you. Don't be silly, right? Yeah, I don't think you need me to say this to you. That doesn't mean if you're driving up somewhere, you have to stop your car and open your car to every man, woman and child to get in. That's not what I'm saying. Be sensible about it. But whenever the opportunity is offered to you, make use of it. Because what you have earned, well deserved. I don't know what you have earned, but whatever it is you have earned, well deserved. If you have earned knowledge, it's because you've given knowledge. Some of the most intelligent people I know are teachers, because what do? The whole of their lives? Helping other people learn. Of course, see, you give and you get. That is a rich man's mindset. So, I just wanted to get that over to you. So, the long and short of all that is, I'm not asking you to not offer anything. That is not what I'm asking you to do, because I know you've earned this out of offering. So, do engage in charity. If you wish to offer something to the Swami Nuhasi, that's totally up to you. That's not to say you must offer either. I've not come here for that. In fact, if the alms bowl was empty, then I could go to more homes and carry on until I collected enough for my meal. But I'm not saying you should stop. Engage in that meritorious deed. Because to me, ultimately, it matters not who does the merit. Whether you do it or someone else does it, it matters not. Because to me, like I said, I don't see you and I don't see them. I just see minds that need salvation. Both the king and a beggar, one in his palace and the other in his shanty. I see no difference. If they both suffer, they suffer because of ignorance and attachment. I'm here for both. No more and no less. I'm here for both. So engage in the meritorious deed as you wish. But as you do so, just be mindful that there are others who will also want to engage in that merit. I mean, if I could stuff myself with as much food as you put into the alms bowl, I wouldn't ask you. Then I'd bring like three alms bowls and go an alms round with, and as soon as one is full, I'll put one to a side and take the other one and go. But I can't do that. You know, this can only take very little. Those days I could eat a lot. But now I can't. Because I only need a little to sustain myself. Sometimes one meal is enough for the whole day. I mean, what do I do? I don't do half the things that you do. Except maybe be responsible for 150 people and practice the path. I don't have to, you know, jump around, fly around, go around. I don't need to do any of that stuff. And as at the monastery, Now you come and serve us our meal, we don't have to go an arms round. But if I had to go in an arms round like this every day, then perhaps I might need a little bit more energy to keep me up and give me the energy to travel. But I don't need a lot like I used to. Does that make sense to anybody, everyone? I hope I haven't offended you or said you shouldn't be making an offering. You haven't misunderstood me, have you? No. Did I ask you to stop making an offering? No. Please do and earn yourself the merits. But you understand that it's not the quantity that earns the merit. It's not the quantity. So it doesn't have to be a big piece of cake. It can just be a tiny bit and it will still earn you merit. It's the intention that you have. Whereas those people, they don't know that it's intention that brings in merit. They think that if they can't offer it, they haven't earned merits. In fact, that happened just before we turned round, when one gentleman came and tried to offer a sandwich or something, I had to say, "Enough, sir, I can't take any more today." I didn't want to do that, but I had to. Because I know I'll never see that person again. But I had to because my arms bowl was full. I couldn't take any more. If I took, then I'd have to throw some of the food away. And I don't want to do that either. Because I know how much love and affection that goes into making that food. Particularly you. If any of you offer something, I know how much devotion, how much respect, how much care and love and go into making that food. So I don't want to throw any of that away. I want you to be able to rejoice in all the merits. So let's do all that sensibly and mindfully so that more people can benefit out of it. Do we have a deal? Okay. Right, I'm going to conclude for today. And just a reminder, we have, I think, now set up a WhatsApp group. I'm informed that the organizers have set up a WhatsApp group through which messages about these sermons can be shared with you in case one gets cancelled or whatever announcements need to be made. So if you haven't yet done so, kindly inform the desk out there of your number and your name, and then they'll add you to that group where you can receive messages. I'm also informed that it's a one-way communication, so no one's going to spam you with any messages. It's only the messages that are sent by the monastery. And secondly, due to popular demand, we have now started making these talks available on YouTube. A lot of people have come and asked me. They've said, "Swaminathan, so on some occasions I have to go to the mosque every other week. So I only come here every alternating week. If you don't mind, can you please put the sermons up so I can watch it the week that I cannot come here? I have to go to the temple the other week. I have to go to the church the other week." And I really respect that. Fulfilling your duties and your obligations. And at the same time, just come here for the philosophy. That's it. Whatever you give to your place of faith. You know, whatever your faith is, give there. Come here for the philosophy. Come empty-handed and leave with a full mind, a full heart. All right. Let's do a transfer of merits and conclude the sermon for today. First and foremost then, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasikas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired to them. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters, who've dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhansay, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all those who've made great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. And may by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves to be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide for the construction of the monastery, as well as those who provide Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines. May they all rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our elders, acquaintances, employers, employees, and to all those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. And may by the power of these merits, they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva as well as all the numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfill the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. And may by the power of these merits they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the members of the Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have predeceased us, our ancestors, and those who have passed away in our name. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force, those who sacrifice their lives for the peace and harmony of our nation. It is thanks to them that today we are able to practice the Dhamma and follow the path to Nibbana in peace and harmony. May they all rejoice in the merits that we have all acquired today. Let us also take this moment to transfer merits to all those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. May they also rejoice in all these merits. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to those who might have lost their lives in natural calamities, such as the tsunamis, earthquakes, landslides, forest fires, blizzards, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this long journey of samsara, they have been mothers and fathers to us, and they've helped, supported and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, by the power of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become an Arahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Theranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen nidatva Dvesha ginnen nidatva Moha ginnen nidatva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita Paravetna Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Paravetna Mamada Siyaru Loka Siyaru Satmayo Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Paravetna Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Paravetna Nibbana Parama Sukhayan sukhita parmatma raga gini niveva dvesha gini niveva moha gini niveva nivansata labeva nivansata labeva Nivan sapa labeva.
Tunduange, suvisi ananta maha guna belen, siru loka siru satyam, nibbana paramasukhen sukta taravitva, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.